appreciate the opportunity to speak before you this afternoon. We're getting towards the end of our study of the harmony of the Gospels, and it's been quite a journey. We're in Jesus' trials right now, and I've been asked to cover Jesus' third Jewish trial and his first Roman trial. Now, you may or may not know, but Jesus actually went through six trials when he was tried. He had three Jewish trials and three Roman trials. I've put up on the board trial 1 through 6, three Jewish trials and three Roman trials with the Gospels. And how many verses each of the Gospels refers to this trial? I thought that was interesting, maybe that's just me. But it shows, I guess, how much importance each of the Gospel writers assigns to each of the trials in their particular gospel. Now, the first trial, well, remember what happened on that night that Jesus had organized for his disciples to prepare the supper in the upper room. Traditionally, that's John Mark's mother's house, the same house that Peter went to when he was miraculously released from prison in the book of Acts. Jesus there, he institutes the he washes the disciples' feet. He tells Judas to leave, and Judas goes to betray him. And then Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper, and he has that long discourse we read about in John, including about other things, about things including, I should say, the Holy Spirit, and how that it was to the disciples' advantage that he depart from there. And then as he's teaching, they leave the upper room, they go up the Mount of Olives, and Jesus continues teaching. They sing a hymn, and they go into the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus asks for them to stay awake and pray for him. He takes Peter, James, and John to the side, and he asks them to stay awake and pray with him. And he goes on a little further and finds them sleeping. Then the mob comes. Apparently, Judas has gone to the house where he left Jesus and didn't find him there. And then he knew that Jesus was often in the Garden of Gethsemane there in the Mount of Olives, so that they take the mob up onto the mountain and find Jesus. Remember, Peter draws his sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus, the high priest's servant, and Jesus heals it and tells Peter, put your sword in its place. Those who take up the sword will die by the sword. And then it says that Jesus' disciples left him and fled. But the mob take him to his first trial, which is only reported in John. They take him to Annas, the high priest. Now remember, there's two high priests, in a sense. There's Annas and Caiaphas. They take him to Caiaphas for the second trial. But Annas was Caiaphas' father-in-law, because at that time, it wasn't like the law of Moses, where the high priest would get passed down father to son when the old high priest died. But at the time, the Romans, they would appoint someone a high priest, and they would strip someone else of his authority. So Caiaphas was the Annas was the high priest. The Romans took that authority away from him and gave it to Caiaphas. It seems like the Jews still regarded him as a high priest in some regard, or at least they gave him a lot of respect and authority. And so they took him to Annas, the high priest, and Annas questioned him about his teachings and about his disciples. Now, this seems like there's something very important for all of the gospel writers, Jesus' disciples, and Jesus, Jesus' faithfulness to his disciples, and his disciples' faithlessness. Because here in each of the Gospels, there's several verses about Jesus' disciples forsaking him. Of course, famously in Mark, there's two verses about the young man who's had a sheet around his naked body, and the soldiers grabbed the sheet and he ran away naked. That's by tradition, that's John Mark, the writer of the Gospel. So there's that disciple that forsook him, two verses before the trials. But in Matthew has seven verses between trials 2 and 3 about Peter denying him. Mark has 13 verses between the second and the third trial. Luke has nine verses, and John actually puts Peter's denial interspersed with the first one. He's got there seven verses. This is significant. His remorse after the third and the fourth trial in the book of Matthew. That's nine verses there. That's significant because in the Gospel of John, the high priest asks him concerning his doctrine and his disciples. Now, does Jesus say, well, you can go and, if you let me go, you can go and get my disciples, round them up, they already forsook me, so I'll forsake them? No. Now, Jesus answers and says that, why are you asking me concerning my doctrine? I have preached the same thing in public, both in the synagogue and in the temple. You ask about me. Now, Jesus specifically says to leave the disciples out of it. Jesus was faithful even when his disciples were faithless. So after going to Annas, it says that Annas sent Jesus bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So we get the second trial. Now, there are some of the priests and the rulers of the people. So it seems like, remember, they had wanted to arrest Jesus for a long time, and they had originally said, not during the Passover, because there's all the pilgrims there for the Passover. The population of Jerusalem was swollen with all these people, a lot of whom liked Jesus, were his followers. They enjoyed hearing him. And so it was a very politically sensitive time. They actually wanted to try him after the Passover, when all these people had left, so that they wouldn't have a riot against the rulers. And so it was a very touchy situation. Could be very explosive for the rulers. So they had just a small band of powerful people, Annas and his home, to try him first, to question him. How can we try Jesus and execute him? And then they bring in their cronies. The most powerful people on the Sanhedrin, the people they knew hated Jesus and wanted him executed. That's the second trial. So it wasn't the full Sanhedrin. It wasn't an official court, but they were bringing in witnesses. They're trying to stack the court. How can we get something to stick on Jesus? Remember, they brought false witnesses in, and they had all these allegations against him, but even the false witnesses couldn't agree. They were all lying, and all their lies didn't match up. So then we have the third trial. Now, you can see only John writes about the first. Incidentally, I think that's because John specifically said the disciple whom Jesus loved knew the family of the high priest, that he was able to get into the courtyard and witness the trial, and he brought Peter in as well. So I think that's why only John writes about it, because he was not a witness to this. You can see that the gospel writers wrote a lot more about the second trial, not very much about the third. Luke writes the most about it. But that's because when it was daylight, when the day dawned, they assembled the whole Sanhedrin. They had figured out how to execute Jesus, how to get a guilty verdict, and now they just needed a rubber stamp. They got the Pax court, the one that only wanted to execute him. Now they brought in the extras. For example, Matthew chapter 27, verse 1, when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. When they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. So we got the third trial. That's just really the rubber stamp. The Jews condemn him to death. But the Jews had a problem. They were not permitted to kill anyone. They weren't allowed to execute. They could have other penalties. Now, the Jews weren't above executing someone if they wanted to. It was illegal and it would get them in trouble. Remember that the Jews stoned Stephen to death in the book of Acts. So they weren't above it. But this was a very politically difficult time. The rulers knew that if this didn't go exactly right, either the people would have a rebellion against them, or the Romans would come away and take away their privileges from them. It's a very politically sensitive time. So they needed to take him to the Romans and have the Romans execute them. Let's look at Luke chapter 12. 22, and we'll start in verse 66. So this is here in the third trial, the third Jewish trial. Luke adds some details, as you can see, he's got some more verses there. So it says, Luke chapter 22, verse 66, as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him to their council, saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will know by no means believe. And if I ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. So what he's saying is, look, I know that this is a throwing forward. I know you've already come to your decision. If I testify to you, you don't care what I have to say. You're just here for a guilty verdict. And if I question you about your witnesses or about your judicial moves, you're not going to answer any questions, and you're not going to let me go, even if I prove my innocence. So it's pointless for me to say something. But he does say something. He says, hereafter the Son of Man will sit at the right hand of the power of God. Well, that's pretty significant, isn't it? I think that's referencing Psalm 110 and verse 1. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send out the rod of strength out of Zion, rule in the midst of your enemies. So Jesus is saying, yes, I am the promised Messiah. He's not denying it. Then they said to him, are you the Son of God? So he said, yes, I am the Messiah. Yes, I am the Son of Man. So now they're saying, are you claiming divinity? Now remember, Jesus had already silenced the Pharisees by asking if David in the Spirit said, the Lord said to my Lord, how is he his son? The point being, the Christ must be the Son of David and the Son of God. He must be divine. So the Pharisees, the rulers are saying, well, is this what you're saying? Remember, they don't want to believe. They just want Jesus dead. They're trying to convict him of blasphemy. Are you the Son of God? He said to them, you rightly say that I am. And they say, what further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. I think the point that Luke is trying to get across here is the rulers were going to convict him no matter what. But they needed a way to do it to convince the people. They needed to be able to say that Jesus blasphemed. Now, Jesus proves later on in his trial, he doesn't have to say anything. He could be silent if he wanted to. But Jesus decided that he was going to proclaim who he was. Now, you and I know at the end of the story that this was all part of God's plan, that Jesus needed to go to that cross, and that he needed to be crucified and die for our sins. This was all according to plan. The point is that Jesus was in control. This wasn't outside of Jesus' control. He was electing to go to that cross. He was allowing this crooked court to convict him. And if he didn't want them to, not just because he was the Son of God, if he didn't want them to, he was wise enough to be able to get out of the situation, but he didn't want to. Okay, so that's the third trial. What about this fourth trial? This is where the Jews then take him bound to Pontius Pilate. Now, you can see that there's not too many verses in any of the Gospels, not as much as, say, the sixth trial, the third Roman trial. But so we're just covering the third and the fourth this afternoon. But I want to kind of give some context and look ahead before we read the text for number four. So what is going to happen is they're taken to Pontius Pilate, and they actually give him different charges. Because did the Romans really care if Jesus blasphemes against the God of Israel? The Romans were very religious, very superstitious, but they were pagans. They had hundreds and hundreds of gods. And it wasn't just their Roman gods that they worshipped. They were happy to worship Egyptian gods and Celtic gods and any gods that were anywhere in the world. They were happy to worship them. So if somebody blasphemed and said, I am the Son of God, well, in their stories and myths and religion, there were all sorts of sons of the gods. The centurion at the cross said, truly, this man is the Son of God. This wasn't something that was unusual in their way of thinking. So Pilate didn't care about blasphemy. So the Jews had to bring a different charge against him. That's why, like in Matthew chapter 27, let's look at Luke 23, verse 2. They began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Is that what they had in his Jewish trials? No mention of that at all. No mention of kings. No mention of taxes. No mention of Caesar. Because the Jews didn't care about those things. They would be happy to follow someone who forbidden paying taxes to Caesar. This is all about blasphemy and all about getting Jesus killed. And so Pilate, it's kind of interesting that the Synoptic Gospels, they don't John, as usual, gives a different perspective. John mentions, let's look at John chapter 18, verse 28. I know we said we'll give you a big picture and then we'd read the text, but let's just go ahead. John chapter 18 and verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas. So they really skipped from the second trial to the fourth trial. I know I've got 0 and 1 here. It's kind of interchangeable. Led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early morning. The Praetorium was the Roman fortress that Pontius Pilate lived in when he was in Jerusalem. He actually lived in a different town, but anyway. But they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. And this is a hypocrisy. They are being so careful not to overstep the smallest rule, the smallest tradition of their fathers, but yet they are blatantly condemning a man to death who is innocent. Not only that, they're lying to the governor about the charges against him. John, through his whole gospel, has this theme of irony, and this is another example here. Pilate went out, verse 29. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said, "If he were an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." They're not even going to tell him what the charges are. "Look, listen, we wouldn't have bothered you early in the morning if he wasn't condemned. He's a bad guy. Just kill him. We don't, it's early, don't worry about it." Pilate is a little brighter than that. Then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore, the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Pilate stuck him in the corner there. Verse 32, notice that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying the death which he would die. Jesus had predicted that the Son of Man would be lifted up on the cross. And Jesus is the prophet of Deuteronomy chapter 32. He predicted his mode of death. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Now, in the Synoptic Gospels, it talks about how Jesus was silent, and Pilate was surprised and said, "Do you not hear all that they are convicting you and testifying against you about?" And Jesus was silent. So we get, according to John's Gospel, in the Synoptics, we get what happened outside of the front of Pilate's palace. John gives us a different perspective. We hear what the conversation when Pilate takes him inside. Now it's just the rumors. The Jews aren't there because they're too worried about being defiled for the Passover. So they have a conversation, Jesus and Pilate. Pilate wants to investigate what's going on? They say that you're a king. They say that you're a rival to Caesar. You don't look like a king. You don't look like someone who is a threat. Are you a threat to imperial Roman power? Are you the King of the Jews? Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you concerning me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Pilate's not stupid. If Jesus really was the King of the Jews wouldn't have delivered him up. They would have held on to him as someone to fight against the power of Rome. The Jews hated the Romans. They hated that they were under imperial control. So Pilate knows there's something else going on. "What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so I would not be delivered to the Jews, but now my kingdom is not from here. But clearly, Jesus' kingdom, he's a king, but not in the conventional sense. Otherwise, he wouldn't be here. Where are the soldiers? Where's the fighting? Where is the defense of the king? He's a king in a different sense. Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him at all." It's hard to know how to take Pilate's statement, "What is truth?" But clearly, he has decided that Jesus is innocent. And whether it's a flippant, sarcastic, or whether it's a nihilistic statement, or whether it's just throwing his hands up in bewilderment, Pilate knows Jesus is not guilty of what the Jews are saying. And he finds him not guilty. So we had guilty, 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 and not guilty. Pilate, who has the power to kill him and the power to release him, says he's innocent. And I think this is a great indictment against the Jewish nation. I think John, in particular, is making a great point. The Jewish leaders are guilty of betraying the Son of God, the one who came to redeem the world, the promised Messiah, who the entire law of Moses was pointing towards. They killed him. Now, later on, in the sixth trial, we'll see how Pilate doesn't get off free. He's guilty as well. But the Jews are guilty here. So, let's finish up by just looking forward very quickly. So, we had the first trial with Annas, kind of trying to figure out what attack that the Jews could go on to get Jesus guilty, just before one man and his inner council. Then we had the second trial where the people who hated Jesus, chief priests and the rulers who were definitely wanting him found guilty and killed, they came together. Then the full court gives it the official stamp of approval, yes, this man's guilty. Then we go before Pilate, and Pilate goes into his praetorium without the Jews and says, "I find no fault in this man. He's clearly not a threat to Rome. Maybe he's guilty according to Jewish law, but we don't care about that." Then we have the fifth trial. That's where Jesus is sent before Herod. Herod finds him not guilty as well. And then we have the sixth trial where Jesus comes back to Pilate. And that's where we read about Barsabbas and how Pilate wants to get out of the situation by, well, let's say I'll release Jesus or release Barsabbas. He thought that the Jews Jesus to release him. But that's what we're going to look at here in a little bit shortly. So, Jesus goes on his third and his fourth trials. And I think the main takeaway of the scriptures that we're looking at this afternoon is that Jesus was in control. Jesus went on trial knowing that he would be arrested, knowing that he would be betrayed with a kiss from one of his closest friends. He knew what the charges were. He knew that he could deny them. He knew that he could use his wisdom to get out of the court. But he affirmed what he was convicted of, that he was the Son of God. He didn't deny, and he didn't question his accusers. And when he was accused before the Jews, he was silent. Jesus was in control because Jesus was resolutely setting his face to the cross so that he could die for men. We'll close there. We'll offer an invitation. Of course, at any time, we can confess our faults one to another. We can, if you're not a member of the church, then at any time, you can ask one of the brethren that you want to be saved, added to the church. But we have this special time of invitation where you can come forward and do that. If you have need the prayers of the church and would like public help, then we invite you to come forward. Or perhaps if you're of the age of accountability and want to be safe, then we invite you to come forward also. We stand and sing the invitation. Psalm 215.